So they're still slowly making their way in the parking lot and just moving by them. But when the rain gets shining and it started on announcements.
Yeah. Good morning. My name is John Arujan, and I'll be your worship associate today. Before we begin, I'd like to focus your attention to the announcements we have up on the screen. We have a grief and care group, caregivers group, this Friday at noon, from noon to one, coming up, as well as Circle Suppers, Saturday, June 8th at 6 o'clock. So go ahead and sign up for those. And is Rachel White here? I'd like to invite her up to speak briefly.
The UUCF board is putting on an RE-wide service project for Pathways of Hope, a talent show, and it'll be from 12:30 to 1:15 today after the service.
If you're not able to stay for the service, please help support us by purchasing a lunch furnished by the Social Action Committee. All proceeds from the lunch and the fundraiser, the talent show fundraiser today, will be going toward Pathways of Hope. This is the RE-wide, all the RE classes decided to focus a service project to the cause of homelessness, and so this is our RE-wide service project for this year, and we thank all of you in advance for all of your support.
Definitely a good cause. We always are big supporters of Pathways of Hope, so I urge you guys to go and check that out after the service. Also, save the date for next Sunday, June 2nd. We have a lot of things going on. We have our flower communion going on. We have a bridging ceremony for our RE youth, as well as appreciation ceremonies to our volunteers and teachers in RE. But please also stay for after the service, because we do have a congregational meeting talking about, we will be approving the slate of candidates and approving the budget, as well as changes to any UUCF bylaws. So please stick around after the service next Sunday for all of that. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Fullerton. I think we have people home in bed looking out at the gray overcast weather this morning that will find their way in along the way. So we will welcome them as they come in. If you are new to our community, we are delighted that you have found us. We continue to search for truth and meaning amidst the challenges in today's world. And in that spirit of hospitality, I now invite you to turn to someone around you and say hello.
Araoka. I'm the piano accompanist here at UUCF. For our opening hymn, we will be singing Enter, Rejoice, and Come In, number 361. Please rise in mind, body, or spirit and join us in singing.
Enter, rejoice, and come in. Enter.
We bid you welcome, by Richard S. Gilbert. We bid you welcome, who come with weary spirit seeking rest, who come with troubles that are too much with you, who come hurt and afraid. We bid you welcome, who come with hope in your heart, who come with anticipation in your step, who come proud and joyous. We bid you welcome, who are seekers of a new faith, who come to probe and explore, who come to learn. We bid you welcome, who enter this hall as a homecoming, who have found here room for your spirit, who find in this people a family. Whoever you are, whatever you are, wherever you are on your journey, we bid you welcome. I'd now like to invite one of our youth, Eden, to light our chalice. I now invite you to join me in saying the words on the screen. This flame affirms the light of truth, the warmth of community, and the fire of commitment. Love is the doctrine that we share. The quest of truth is our sacrament, and service is our prayer.
To smell together in peace,
to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve human need, thus do we covenant with one another.
Just like to offer you a quick pledge update. We had a goal of 240,000, and we currently have $224,807 pledged, which means we have $15,193 to go if we want to make that ambitious goal. I would like to just give you a little update too about where we are as a community, what our hopes and dreams are for the future, and kind of some of the challenges that we face at this particular moment. And I'd like to start by having us all read our mission statement together. Now, this is the statement that this congregation articulated a few years ago to really explain what it was, what our purpose is, why we're here, and why we do what we do. So if you'll read this with me. We are a welcoming spiritual community for all ages, living our principles through active service, embracing each other and the wider world. So, that's what we set out to do as a community. And let me tell you a little bit about some of the challenges we face with that sometimes. We have parking issues here in our particular location. And one of the things I've heard from some folks recently is we even have some people who have not been able to find spaces close enough. They are disabled, and they've had one of their party driving around and sitting in the car during the service rather than being able to come in. We've also had a few people who have admitted to me that they've come late and they weren't able to find parking in our lots or on the street, and so they just went home. These are things to think about. Our current congregation is around 215 people. In my estimation, with the parking, with the space available to us, that is as large as we can be in this location. And frankly, it is a little large for this location. With the parking issues and with other obstacles that we face, which I'll talk about in just a minute, it's a challenge. I believe our current pledges are likely where we will be with this size congregation as we go forward. Now, we know we've had a lot of newcomers to our community, and traditional wisdom says, well, newcomers pledge a little bit less, and as years go by and they become more connected to the community, they pledge more. That's true. But what happens in today's world is a lot of our newcomers are younger people. And those younger people, whether they be in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, even their early 50s, It's a different economic situation than for many of you who are older than that when you were back in that same age bracket. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in the sermon today. This sort of intersects with some of the things that I'll be talking about later. But it is a challenging time to be a 30-something, a 40-something year old trying to raise a family and so on. We've got a lot of people who are really struggling and will not be able to give the same at the same level that people who are from a different generation are able to. This is just a reality that we have to navigate as we think about going forward. This idea of our mission and living into this, I think the first part of this is we're welcoming spiritual community for all ages. I think that's a little challenging to truly serve all these different age groups when we don't necessarily have the financial resources to do the programming that we need to do to meet those different age groups' needs. And so, as you know, one of the things behind our pledge campaign this year was to try and fund positions for our junior high and our high school program, and even maybe the dream was a young adult program. And that's still on the table, and we're still going to work toward that next year, but it's definitely a challenge to think about. How do we live into our mission of serving all ages, especially as we know our financial resources don't necessarily grow at the same rate as our membership grows? As we talked about, it's hard to do that active service that this mission talks about when we are located here in a place that's not easy to get to, not particularly visible, can be hard to find. And it's a lovely place, and we have a lot of wonderful memories here. And this may be where this congregation continues to build and create memories. But it is a challenge here. Embracing one another, as this mission statement talks about, it's something that we can certainly do with the community that we've had here. But we've had trouble because we've grown so quickly. And we have 100 new people that need to get to know the 100 plus people who were here before. And how do you do that when you have very limited access to the large spaces in these two buildings here? Our lease doesn't allow us to be in these spaces except for very particular times. So the kind of program we've been able to offer have been things that appeal to a smaller group of people in our community room, for instance, rather than things that we know many people would turn out for, you know, a congregation-wide talent show and evening to have those social time that's so important. All those things that so many people here would love to offer, we haven't been able to because of our space issues. And we didn't, this last year, as we were working to negotiate a new lease, we didn't want to set a precedent of paying the high rental rates they were asking us to, because we weren't sure what the future would look like. So now we are signing a new lease here, and it pretty much looks like our old lease, and it pretty much looks like we will be kind of locked into using the space in the same way we used it this last year, which is under very particular circumstances. Maybe if we're able to get even more pledges in as we round out this church year, we'll be able to think about renting this sanctuary and social hall for some other large event that could really help pull our community together. But again, it's, you know, something that is challenging right now with in terms of our finances and in terms of the availability of this building. So what is leadership considering at the moment? Well, we're still in talks with the congregation that we talked about moving in with before. That's not completely dead, but it definitely has its challenges. We're also looking at making partnerships with other congregations in the community. We do have one that we are talking to about. They're looking for a new place, and maybe we could look together, possibly get into a rent-to-own situation. We don't know. You know, they understand our needs, and that we want to look forward to how this community can continue to be sustainable. I think that while renting offers some very positive things for this community, it's also very challenging, because as our rent has continued to go up and taken such a significant amount of the financial resources we have, there's really no opportunity to save money to purchase our own building or do whatever it is this congregation ultimately wants to do. And you're in a unique boat. You really are, because you're 51 years old now, and you rent. And that's unusual for a congregation. Usually, a congregation that's been able to survive over 51 years and grow to 200 people do so in a building of their own. Well, you haven't. And so you've beaten the odds, because that's unusual, but it also puts you in a position that you don't have a building to sell. So we have to think about creative ways. Again, whether it's in this space or whether it's looking outward at possibilities in the community, a creative way that we can continue to sustain this congregation and even grow it, if that's what this congregation wants to do, but also with the limitations we have as far as some of these things go. But I'm asking you, because I think this is actually really positive. We're in a place where we're thinking about options and choices. We're thinking about how we can continue to navigate the demands of this community and our call to do this work in the world. And that's exciting. I mean, that's really exciting. And we're also at a point where we need to be thinking about our mission with every decision we make. Are we living that out? Are we making decisions that help us to be that welcoming spiritual community for all ages? Are we finding opportunities for everyone to be engaged in that active service in the larger world? And are we figuring out how to embrace those people right here within our congregation and also those folks out in the wider world? I think we can do all of those things. I have a lot of faith in this community. I have a lot of faith in our message. I think it's going to be challenging. I think it requires out-of-the-box thinking. I want to be really transparent about how challenging this can be, so I'm sharing this with all of you. I'm making this what do we call it? It's an opportunity. It's not a problem. It's an opportunity. I'm making this opportunity all of our opportunity, because really that's what this congregation is. It is our congregation to figure out where we're going and what we're doing and what that looks like along the way. So, I say all of this with gratitude for the time, talent, and treasure that all of you contribute in the ways that you are able. And I do hope that you continue to be inspired by our mission and the work that we do here at UUCF.
This month's food challenge is canned fruit. Each Sunday, our children collect food donations to provide for those in need. We invite the children to sit up front for the Time for All Ages presentation before going to their educational classes.
So before Rachel shares our story this morning with all of us, I wanted to just explain a little bit about how this fits in with our service. This is a story about a homeless family, and I believe the latest count, which just came out very recently, and somebody else probably knows better than me, the homeless here in Orange County number around 3,000. And so one of the things that we're talking about as we talk about class this morning is this idea that we don't always see class in the same way that we maybe have thought traditionally about class. And so this is the story of one homeless family that continues on despite the challenges that they face. And I think it probably helps us get a little bit more awareness about what's going on right in our own backyard, so to speak.
Still a family. We live in the city shelter, my mom, my doll, and me. My dad lives in a different shelter down another street, but we are still a family. I sleep on a cot near my mom. Bunk beds border the walls in a large room. People snore, subways roar, buses, cars, and taxis honk. I toss and turn and try to fall asleep. I miss my quiet room, my comfy bed, and my cozy quilt. I cuddle with my doll, Molly, And even though my dad isn't here to tuck me in, we are still a family. While the older kids are at school, I play. Cots make fun forts. Sometimes I don't want to come out from under the bed. I share my doll with the girl beside me. We take turns all afternoon. My new friend calls Molly Madeline. I think it's okay if my doll has two names. Some days we meet my dad at the park. We slide on slides. Hide and seek is our most favorite game of all. Sometimes we stop to pet puppies or sniff the flowers. We are together and we are still a family. I love you to the moon and back, Dad says. I love you to the moon and back two times, I reply. Dad blows us a kiss. We catch it in the air quick. My mom, my doll, and me. We blow kisses back and forth until we are out of sight. And even though Dad goes one way and we go another, we are still a family. One rainy day, we fish a tattered tarp out of a trash can and we make a lean-to. My head gets wet, but I don't care. Mom finger combs my hair and then braids it. Dad hugs us both tight in that small squish space. We are together and we are still a family. My parents look for work every day to take turns taking care of me. We scrimp and save all our pennies. We eat, and even though my shoes are a little snug, I don't complain too much. We stand in long lines that snake around the corner. Waiting such a long time to eat is hard, but I try my best to smile. And even though my belly grumbles, I share my food with my doll. She likes the beef stew best of all. Days and weeks and months go by. We celebrate holidays, and even though we live in different shelters, we are still a family. On my birthday, Dad lights a candle on my chocolate cupcake. Make a wish, my mom says. I close my eyes tight. Then I blow out the candle, share my cupcake with my doll, and smile, because we are still a family. And let's go to our classes.
Before we begin our time of joys and sorrows, I wanted to take a moment to offer a reflection on Memorial Day, which of course is tomorrow, Monday. So I invite you into the spirit of meditation, prayer, and reflection. We enter into this time of Memorial Day surrounded by such a cloud of witnesses. We remember first of all the women and men who are currently serving in the armed forces, and we pray for their safety. We also acknowledge that there are women and men who will not return as we grieve their passing. We pause to honor their service and their sacrifice. We also pause this moment to give thanks for all the women and men who have served in the nation's armed services. Those who have not served cannot fully imagine the experience of war. But we do know war's aftermath and the toll that it can take on the human heart. This day remembers and acknowledges loss, and so do we remember those whom we have loved and lost. We hold their names and their faces in our mind's eye. We recall the gifts they gave to us through the strength of their being, the depth of their love, the courage of their dying, and the fullness of their living. Let their memories surround us as we continue in our time of worship and community. And as we begin our time of joys and sorrows, I'll ask John to light a candle for Memorial Day. And John, if you would also light a candle for Bruce Reback's mother, who is ill. And our thoughts are with Bruce and Debbie and her. And I invite you to come forward if you do have a personal, brief joy or sorrow you'd like to share. This is the time to do so.
Hi, I'm Judy Herz, and for 17 years, I attended the UU Musicians Network Conference, where I was able to participate in handbell hand chime choirs. And I had a vision of bringing the instruments over to our congregation to share them so that we could have involved children as well as adults in the joy of ringing. And so with the support of Reverend John Dobra, we purchased 4 octaves of hand chimes, and we have been ringing. We've had 2 choirs for 10 years. I learned last year that after next week, the golden chimes will no longer ring, and we will only have 1 more year before the family chimes are phased out. I'm very sad about that.
Thanks, Judy. And just a clarification, the chimes program will continue to exist. It's just being reshaped by the board at the moment.
Okay, all right, well, I'll use it anyway. I just want to take a moment to honor the best production in the entire universe, the birth of my husband 55 years ago. He's my best friend, and even though sometimes I don't like what he does, I really like him as a person because he's amazing. Hi, everyone. I just wanted to share, on Wednesday I had this great opportunity to head up to Sacramento and march with teachers for public funding, and it was a great event. There are some bills that passed that some people are on either side of, but to just see the energy and the support for our educational system was just amazing. So I just wanted to share that.
I just wanted to share a joy and my thanks to the congregation. Started coming here about 3 years ago when we first moved back, and I just experienced so much love and support and frankly, growth for me personally. First through the choir with Eleanor and Kristen, and then with Rose London with the performance of the Vagina Monologues with our social justice group. And it inspired me to look for more opportunities to participate. And recently, I started taking classes at Fullerton College with playwriting and directing. A work that I directed for my final last week has now been accepted to the Summer Directors Festival at Fullerton College. So I'll be directing a full-length piece, and I'm super excited. And then 3 pieces I wrote, which will be directed by other directors in that summer festival. And in the fall, I will be attending CalArts, the California Institute of the Arts, for an MFA in creative writing. And I really thank all the people here, the wonderful opportunities I've had here and the great conversations at Camp de Benneville. They were all very, very meaningful to me, and thank you so much.
And I'd like to invite one candle to be lit for Jean Preble. I spent yesterday evening with Jean in the hospital. Jean is struggling right now. It's a challenging time, and her kidneys are shutting down, and it doesn't look like dialysis is probably an option for her. So, Jean, if you know Jean, and if you didn't, I think you'll get, her personality will come through. And when I say, I mean, she is a spitfire. And even still, in the hospital last night, she was ordering those nurses around, and she definitely knew what she needed to help her through that time. So our thoughts go to Jean. Those of you who already visit Jean, I know she deeply, deeply appreciates that, and she will certainly be in our thoughts and prayers in the coming days ahead. I invite you into a time of prayer, reflection, and meditation. We sit this moment amidst change and possibility. Both of which can stir our excitement, but also invite in our fears. As a community, we have been through challenges together, joys and triumphs, and also sorrows. And certainly each of us individually has faced disappointment, have had things in our lives that have not gone the way we planned, have struggled to find our way through. I find my heart is grateful for this community this morning, grateful for the connections it offers to people in the world, and on a personal level, grateful for my own connection to it. I invite you into a moment of silence to consider where you find gratitude in your life and in this community. This morning, we consider how to draw the circle wider. What does it mean to open our hearts and our doors up to those who might not find us? Might not find us without our intention to be found. There is an aspect of humanity that sometimes invites us to hide. Hide who we are, hide the truth of our beings, hide the realities that connect us to each other. But this morning, we search to be found. Found by those who need us. And in so doing,
we perhaps find ourselves.
When Jason handed me the script he wanted me to read this morning as our reading, I was struck by the fact that it comes from a book, Elite, by Mark Harris, who's always been a controversial fellow, that I read a couple of years ago, and what a difficult read it was, a real wake-up call. So I hope you experience that same sense, even from this small excerpt. We don't talk about class very much in Unitarian Universalist circles, giving far more time and energy to race. Class is a hard subject to talk about because many of us grew up believing that America has no class structure, or that most everyone is middle class. And even if you are poor, we're still all created equal, and you too can grow up to be president of the United States. We sometimes say we are all getting richer, or that everyone has an equal chance to succeed. And yet, in many ways, class is the most important predictor of what kind of opportunities someone will have in life. We are stratified financially, socially, and educationally in ways predicted by class. A minister is upper middle class by virtue of education, even if he or she does not make much money. Unitarian Universalists say they want to work toward greater equality by creating a multicultural and multiracial faith. But how do we do that with respect to class if our racial and cultural diversity all comes from the same socioeconomic group? Then again, perhaps it doesn't. We may be more diverse than we think and accept the elite stereotype to evoke liberal guilt. The essential question is, who belongs with us? Sometimes Unitarian Universalists believe the stereotype that we are only educated suburbanites, when it's clearly not true. Many Unitarian Universalists live in marginal economic circumstances or do not have college educations. I believe that at heart, Unitarian Universalists long to have a faith that learns from all kinds of people, rich and poor. I never want to feel there is anyone, including myself, who does not belong. Margaret Fuller, a leading transcendentalist, who is sometimes called America's first feminist, once wrote to her Unitarian father, "Your reluctance to go among the strangers cannot too soon be overcome, and the way to overcome it is not to remain at home, but go among them and resolve to deserve and obtain the love and esteem of those who have never before known you. With them, you have a fair opportunity to begin the world anew." Our theology says this vision to begin the world anew must be with all kinds of people, not just with the social circle we create or like-minded liberals. It must be practiced in an ever-intentional manner and in ever-widening circles if our faith is going to be truly transformational. Perhaps this is how Unitarian Universalism can fulfill its democratic vision and become more than a faith for the few.
So when I first considered coming to UUCF and serving as minister, I thought I'd better do my research on this local area. Now, of course, I've lived in Santa Ana for over 10 years, so I knew Fullerton, had been to Fullerton, but I didn't really know much about its demographics. So one of the things I came across in my research was an article from 2014. It originated with the news real estate site Movoto, but was picked up by other news sites internationally. It's headlines all over the place. Fullerton is talked about in a significant way in this article. Any guesses as to what the article is about? Well, I'll give you the headline right here. "These are the 10 snobbiest mid-sized cities in America." "Do you turn your nose up at anything unrefined, then you might feel right at home in these supremely snobby cities." Now, California made the list several times. Pasadena's number one, Thousand Oaks is number two, Santa Rosa's number five, Glendale and Sunnyvale are 7 and 8, respectively, and Fullerton, our dear Fullerton, is listed as the 9th snobbiest mid-sized city in the United States. Now, how did they determine what was snobby? Well, the data included median home price, median household income, percent of population with a college degree, and then per capita, private schools, performing arts, art galleries, and country clubs. So the more the city has of those things, the higher their ranking on this snobby scale. And then they also looked at fast food restaurants per capita, but in this case, the fewer there were, the higher the ranking. Now, you may not define the combination of these characteristics as snobby in the same way this article does, and there's no doubt that this term was used to generate a provocative headline. It worked, got picked up all over the world. But the truth is that this article does gesture toward what we're talking about today, this idea of class. And the takeaway for me is that Fullerton is, at least in some ways, an elite place, to use the word from our reading this morning. And as we pointed out in that reading, Americans have typically like to think that we are beyond class, that everyone has a fair shot to achieve the so-called American dream, and probably as a reaction to what we rebelled against from the British, that mannered class hierarchy. And we've been positioning ourselves and our socioeconomic backgrounds all this time as regular people. And certainly our current president has mastered that skill by touting himself as a regular guy who eats fast food and whose most notable campaign iconography is a ball cap. The current US president has all the trappings of someone who operates outside of class, someone who is just a so-called regular guy, untainted by money and power. Now, we know that's a myth, don't we? But it's a myth that so many people, American people, especially people who are struggling, especially people who feel disenfranchised, that's a myth they want to buy into. The myth that we are classless as an American society and that those who make up the top 1% of income are just like us. The myth that there are no divisions that distinguish us from one another financially or socially. Of course, one of the things that complicates understanding class in America is that it's not just about money. Unlike some cultures that keep people pigeonholed in the particular class they are born into, Americans have the potential for moving across class lines. But as we've seen with various systematic forms of oppression, there are still invisible obstacles, often in place, that keep people from moving across class barriers. If you're born poor and black, for instance, if you're born disabled, if you're born the child of an immigrant, and on, all these things can make it very difficult to move up the proverbial ladder. And class in America is supremely complicated. It's a whole intersection of characteristics. How much money do you have? How much education? How do you carry yourself? What is your speech like? Where do you live? Who are your neighbors? Now, I'm going to refrain from using traditional class terminology today, like working class or middle class or upper class, because those terms no longer seem to have the same meaning they had in 1950s America. According to the results of a two-year project by NBC, which included extensive U.S. polling data, quote, since the Great Recession, Americans have experienced economic tumult that has rattled our class categories. Unionized industrial work is now a relic in many places, and post-recession job growth has clustered in lower paid fields with fewer worker protections. Those at the top of the economy are becoming wealthier, even as the bottom grows and the middle hollows out. Nowadays, it's not uncommon to find someone who is 30 years old with a college degree, maybe even a graduate degree, living with parents and working at a minimum wage job. I'd venture to say there's probably somebody in this room who fits into that category. There's no traditional class terminology that neatly fits the complexities of that situation. Josh Clinton, a political science professor at Vanderbilt University, said, "Class is perception. It's the way we think about ourselves, about how we see ourselves in comparison to others, about where we came from and where we live, as much as it is the objective indicators." So it's not necessarily how much money do you have, but how much money are you comfortable being around? It's not about whether you ever eat at a fast food restaurant, but are you also comfortable eating at a fancy French restaurant? It's not whether you technically have a college or graduate degree, but are you comfortable associating with those who do? Does your speech immediately indicate where you were born, or do you speak with the neutral accent of a network television presenter? Class, it's tied up in a thousand little and big things that we do, and we give off indicators to let people know where we do and where we don't belong. We also do what we can to perpetuate that American myth that we are classless. Those with money, especially in liberal communities like this one, often downplay their wealth. You wouldn't know who has money based on their clothes or their jewelry. And certainly as I've reflected on this topic this week, I recognize how many stories I told you from the pulpit of times that were financially hard for my family while I was growing up. It's my way of letting you know I've seen tough times. Some of my character was formed out of those times. But I've also conveniently left out the story of the wealth my family came into as my father's career ascended. I've not talked about our move to an impressive Tudor mini mansion during my high school years, or the years he worked in Sydney, Australia, and we traveled back and forth to a penthouse apartment facing the legendary Opera House. I'm coming out this morning. Like our president, with whom I hope I share little else in common with, I've engaged in the uniquely American way of downplaying class differences, even as the realities of class lines remain very challenging to cross for some people. But in my estimation, not so much for people who find their way to a UU community. And this is where it gets really complicated. Because of course there are significant economic disparities in this room. There are differences in the levels of formal education, differences in where we come from. But what you all have in common is that you're all educated, either self-educated, educated by experience, or by formal institutions. And I say that because if you weren't, you wouldn't be here, because frankly, we haven't made it easy to find Unitarian Universalism. You have to be exceptional in certain ways to even find your way to our doors. And above all, you're all pretty comfortable with navigating across class lines because you do it in this community and often very seamlessly. That's not a bad thing in today's world. In fact, adapting to navigate various social classes is a great skill, and it's no surprise to find people with that skill in a UU community. Unitarianism, for instance, has a long history of being elite in its way, often without recognizing it. Now remember, we come out of the Puritan movement. People who fled England with very little, they lived there on the margins of society, but then there they were in New England, the leaders of American society. So from the beginning, we've seen ourselves as both marginalized and elite. The Universalists, who tended to be less society-minded than the Unitarians, still weren't free from their class biases. In Elite, Mark Harris writes, when Clarence Russell Skinner, the great Universalist social activist, published The Social Implication of Universalism, he declared, the new enthusiasm for humanity readily pictures a time when through eugenics, education, friendship, play, worship, and work, the criminal will be no more. Birth control or even sterilization are ways to control indiscriminate breeding. Eugenics and forced sterilization, not the first thing we think of when we think of Universalism's core affirmation that every person is loved. In the mid-20th century, the American Unitarian Association's expansion effort identified barriers that might work against a successful startup of a Unitarian congregation in a new community. These included the percentage of foreign-born and Negro populations, and other criteria including how people earned their living, what they read, and whether they were interested in high culture and higher education. Clearly, we have a long history of classing ourselves into being a faith movement for a person comfortable navigating class lines in particular ways. That doesn't ignore our differences, but it suggests a certain kind of person who can navigate those lines. And my question then is, does that serve our call as well as we could be serving it? A few years ago, and this is a story that's hard to tell, complicated, as so many of these stories are about class, but when I was serving another congregation, I used to get my lunch most weekdays from a local grocery store. There were a man and woman employed there who usually helped me, and we'd chat a bit as they prepared my food, and I began to look forward to those interactions. And then one day they asked me what I did for a living. When I answered, they responded enthusiastically, "We'll have to visit your church." And my heart sank. These two people were so kind, and through my conversations with them, I knew they shared many of the values dear to our UU communities, but I also knew they had a variety of characteristics that would make it hard for them to fit in. The way they spoke, their backgrounds, financial resources, ethnicity, all these things would get in the way of them being a part of that UU church I was then serving. And that broke my heart. It was experience that it made me see who felt comfortable sticking around in that congregation and who didn't. And as hard as that is to say, I guess until we get real and acknowledge these things, we're going to lose out on some people who really need us. And we need them. But Reverend Jason, some will say, we can't be everything to everybody, can we? And I say, yes, I agree. We can't be everything to everybody. But we are situated in a unique corner of liberal religion, and I think what comes with that is a unique responsibility. We offer an expansive space to sit in. Who else says that you can be an atheist, an agnostic, or a theist and still be welcome? Who else says you can keep the best parts of another faith tradition, whether that be Judaism or Christianity or Buddhism or Hinduism or whatever, and still join with our faith tradition? Who else not only says but also works for the worth and dignity of every person? Who's been historically a leader for women's rights, rights for people of color, for immigrants, for LGBTQ identified individuals, and on and on? We have something that is utterly unique. And right now, as I mentioned before, the path to get to us requires a daunting level of either self-education or formalized education, and comfortability and experience in navigating multiple social classes. That's a lot of prerequisites to find your way through the door here. What would our community be like if, when I or some of our other people in the room go to speak at an immigrant rally, that we knew we could pass out cards to those immigrants who thank us and invite them to actually show up on Sunday morning, and that we'd be ready for them, whatever that means? I think theologically it comes down to one thing: love. In inviting people in, we have to lead with love. Not lead with our intellects, not lead with our occupations or our world travels, we lead with love. That means that anyone who shares our principles, who appreciates the worth and dignity of every human being, and who can see how we are all interconnected, that those people, wherever they come from, would feel connected to us because we have lovingly opened our arms to them. And this is important. Because if we figured out how to open ourselves beyond class, there are a lot of people out there who would be saved by being with us. And when I say save, what I mean is reminded of their worth and dignity. Reminded and affirmed that they are loved. Reminded that they have the invitation to cultivate their intellects and move beyond the few other options for religious life they see so much more visibly on display in this country. Do I need to say this is important in today's world? I don't think so. I think we know we are kind of losing the battle, folks. It's not lost. It's not hopeless. But we're tipping toward losing. We've seen public discourse move away from being thoughtful, rational, conscience-based to something far more dangerous. We've seen lines of division forming that seem like they will be hard to erase. We have seen sweeping religious movements drawing more and more people to the side of fear and prejudice of difference. And people of liberal faith have done very little to cross out of our comfort zones to offer something to people who have historically been outside of our elite class category. And frankly, I think it's that we just have trouble seeing it and we don't know what to do. But if we could figure out what to do, what would that look like? What would we be able to accomplish if there were more people represented at the table when we work to make the changes so desperately needed in our world today? And perhaps most importantly, what would it mean to our call, that call of our souls, if you will, to the soul work every human being has to do? What would it mean if we were able to be more than what we are, if we drew the circle of inclusion wider? Surprise, I don't have the answer to all these questions. If I did, I'd be running everything, wouldn't I? But I do know we should be asking them. And I do know that this is our, forgive the religious language, but this is our holy work to draw the circle wider.
We know that this community of caring will continue to do good work in this world. We thank you for your generosity.